the Indie Week, a program by the North Carolina Reading Service for our audience of blind and print impaired listeners. Indie Week is a weekly publication. I'm John Federson, and I'll be reading this issue, which is dated June the 30th of 2023. And here we go. The issues, as I've been relating for the last few issues, are beginning to change from the simple print edition, which comes out once a week, to a updated website, indieweek.com, from which I pulled all of my articles today. There are some articles from the past that I haven't gotten a chance to read before. And all this is due to the fact we never know how much information is going to be included now in these issues, whether they'll fill up an hour or whether I need to select past articles or put some aside if it's a heavy week. They're changing their formats, and we'll keep you abreast of details of what they'll be, whether we can even continue the broadcast if they if their content gets much thinner. We'll have to see. But in any event, I'll begin this broadcast with an article from all over the state, and as they've been doing, some of them are in a week or two older. The first of those, by Jasmine Gallup, comes printed currently on June 28th. Raleigh's purchase of the old DMV building provides a unique opportunity, it's titled, but can residents trust city leaders to get it right? Isaac White Sr. knows exactly where the old state DMV headquarters used to be. It's just a few blocks away from his longtime home in the Battery Heights neighborhood of southeast Raleigh. Today, the roughly six-acre property located at the corner of South Tarboro and New Bern Avenue is still home to an old squat brick building with a fading sign reading NC Department of Motor Vehicles. But the facility is clearly deserted, with an empty parking lot that has weeds growing through cracks in the pavement. It's a remnant of the neighborhood's powerful past, like many places in Battery Heights. As rich Raleighites move east and developers replace old one-story houses with 800,000 mini-mansions, residents in the historically black neighborhood are struggling to hold on to their homes. White says, everywhere, things are getting more expensive. It's the gentrification, how people come in where they wouldn't used to come in. That's fine, now you're desiring to live here, but my taxes double and triple. Property taxes aren't the only costs going up in southeast Raleigh. Basic commodities like gas and groceries are also more expensive, according to White. And it's not just economics. White can see his community changing around him. His neighbors aren't the same. His friends are being forced out. He says, we worked hard to get over here. Now you're going to punish us? I love where I live at. I plan on living there till the Lord take me home, but I'm saying don't penalize me and tax me to death. For White and other southeast Raleigh residents, the state-owned plot of land off New Bern Avenue represents a huge opportunity. For years, Raleigh Mayor Pro Tem Corey Branch and other city council members have been talking with state officials about buying the property. Earlier this month, the city filed a $20 million bid. The North Carolina Council of State approved it. There are still a few more hoops to jump through, but the city will likely finalize that purchase soon. This is important because large plots of land near downtown Raleigh rarely come up for sale. And when they do, there's extremely high demand from developers, many of whom propose building 20-story apartment buildings or dense townhome neighborhoods to take advantage of Raleigh's booming real estate market. The city's purchase of the land means it can control what to do with it, instead of leaving it to the whims of the private market. Raleigh's bid has raised a powerful, fragile hope among residents who want to see the property used for something good, a project that will help the community, such as low-income housing or a local grocery store, or both. White says, a place where my kids can afford to live in zip code 27610. That's what I would love to see. The majority of people I know now, they're having to go to Knightdale, Wendell, Clayton, and Johnston County because they can't afford to be in that area. I understand we can't go back, but we can recognize what's going on here now. A short walk away at Martin Street Baptist Church, Dr. Sean Singleton says he'd like to see a business in the area, like a Lowe's Foods or Sheetz gas station. The Village District, for example, has stores that attract people and incentivize them to spend money locally, he says. Why not replicate that in Southeast Raleigh? And he says, one of the things that is lacking in the community is something that allows people to spend their dollars in the community. In order for people in that community to go grocery shopping, they have to relocate and go somewhere else. Singleton and other church leaders will likely have a large voice in that project, since the church owns about 3.3 acres of property right across the street from old DMV headquarters. Before the DMV moved to Rocky Mount in 2020, back when it employed hundreds of local residents, the church leased much of its property to the state for employee parking. Corey Branch, who represents many Southeast Raleigh residents in District C, says he's already in conversation with church leaders who will help determine the future of the site. After the city officially purchases the property, the next step will be to hold conversations with the community to see what they want to be built, Branch says. And he says, right now, I think we're at a point of let's put everything on the table. Let's have a more meaningful conversation with the community and then go from there and see how we're going to pay for what is built. There are some key stakeholders in the area the city wants to hear from, Branch says, like the local Wake County Library and State Employees Credit Union. He adds the city could potentially partner with these or other nearby organizations like Wake Med, Wake Tech, or St. Augustine's University to provide more medical care, job training, or education opportunities. When Branch looks at the property, he sees a mixed-use development, he says, land that could be home to a combination of housing, retail, and office or institutional space. And he says the community needs a grocery store, a place for business owners to operate, even doctors or attorneys' offices, things that people need for their day-to-day life. I mentioned the library. That gives access to a place to meet. And then there's housing, looking at housing challenges and needs, so definitely something mixed use is needed there. The project will likely be built in phases, with construction 2 to 3 years away, says Branch. Before the shovels break the ground, the city has to decide what it wants built on the site and send out a request for proposal, an RFP, to developers and other organizations. These RFPs are essentially challenges to see who can come up with the best and most cost-effective plan for the city. The city council gives applicants guidelines that the project should include a certain amount of affordable housing, for example. Applicants then submit proposals that the city council selects. This process often determines how a project will be paid for. A business partnership between the city and a developer or contractor, for instance, could influence how the property is used. Branch says overall the project could be a game changer. When the DMV headquarters first moved out, locals lost more than 300 jobs that were vital to our community, he says. Now the city has the potential to build something equally impactful. Quote, we're doing bus rapid transit right here on this corridor. So when we look at bus rapid transit, the opportunity for jobs as well as housing. That's why I was like, hey, it's good that we own it. One thing I've always said to individuals is that she or he who owns the dirt controls what happens to it. Singleton says if the city does the right thing, it's the development of the property could make a huge difference. Unfortunately, he doesn't see that happening. He says, I have no optimism at all. That doesn't sound good coming from a pastor, but look at the way things are trending. The city may be buying the property right now, but who influences what the city does with it will tell the story. And I believe who's going to really influence what the city does are the other stakeholders and the rapid transit expansion. The city's plan for building new bus rapid transit lines includes a route on Newbern Avenue, which makes the property even more valuable to city officials and developers alike. Singleton says if you look at these plans and how they're designing the Newbern Avenue corridor, that new design does not fit with attracting low-income families. I've seen it. I've been to the meetings and I said, this doesn't look like you're trying to designate a portion of whatever housing gets put here for low income. Singleton, like some other Raleighites, suspects the land will become fancy new apartments or other homes or businesses that are unaffordable for existing residents. People know that the property is a great opportunity for the community, but don't seem to trust the city council with its future. White says, I understand the city saying that they want to get it before developers. And Raleigh Mayor Mary Ann Baldwin, she talks a good game about affordable housing, but that's a catch-all. What does that really mean? Affordable to who? The city has already faced criticism from residents over its plans for another valuable piece of property, about 3 acres of land located around Moore Square. Last year, after asking for RFPs, the city decided on a proposal from Loden Properties, a major developer with projects across Raleigh, including the Target on Hillsborough Street. Plans for Moore Square land include an apartment complex with more than 500 units, at least 160 of which would be rented below market rates as affordable housing. The complex will also include a grocery store, and Loden has pledged to build a new permanent building for Raleigh Rescue Mission on the site. Nearby, the developer plans to build a 160-room boutique hotel and co-working space. Housing advocates say the plans don't do enough to create more affordable housing for the people who really need it, especially those who are making less than 30% of the area's annual median income, which is around $117,000 for a family of four in Raleigh. City officials, on the other hand, said they were impressed with the amount of affordable apartments included in the proposal and appreciated the inclusion of a new building for Raleigh Rescue, which works to end homelessness. When it comes to this project, Branch says the next steps are still being formalized, but, quote, the community will be engaged while looking at ways to pay for the development. How seriously the city takes the community's input is yet to be determined. Next, Tomasi McDonald. Durham's Hayti District receives $10 million in newly adopted budget for rebuilding. Last spring, 3 months after her historic election as Durham's first black woman, Mayor Elaine O'Neill pretty much promised to rebuild Hayti, one of the nation's most important black neighborhoods during the Jim Crow era. The long-deferred dream of restoring one of Durham's most storied neighborhoods moved closer to reality this month. Last Tuesday, one day after the Juneteenth holiday, Durham City Council members approved a $610 million budget for the new fiscal year and allocated $10 million to revitalize Hayti, the traditionally black community that sits in the eastern shadow of downtown, to, quote, help create a sense of place for this historic area, according to the City of Durham website. City officials added that funding will support a variety of efforts, including residential and commercial real estate programs, small business support, and street, sidewalk, and landscape improvements. The funds to rebuild have been a long time coming. It has been decades since the broken promises of a federal urban renewal program during the 1960s devastated Haiti. Hundreds of businesses and thousands of homes were bulldozed to make room for the construction of Highway 147 that cleaved the heart of the community. North Carolina Central University historian Jerry Gershenswern noted in his biography, Louis Austin and the Carolina Times, that prior to its destruction, many blacks viewed Haiti, with its 4,000 homes and 500 businesses, as, quote, a vibrant though poor African-American community which suffered because of overcrowding and inadequate housing. Gershenswern explained that in 1962, voters approved an $8.6 million bond referendum to finance water, sewer, and street improvements in the Haiti district. The goal, per recommendations by UNC Chapel Hill's Department of City and Regional Planning, was to clean up and modernize 200 acres of Haiti to improve the city's tax base and make room for a planned east-west expressway. Highway 147 was built, but the rebuilding of homes and businesses in Haiti never followed. Despite the destruction, the community is still home to a host of stable institutions, including the Haiti Heritage Center, the Stanford Warren Library, Student U, W.D. Hill Recreation Center, the Lincoln Community Health Center, and NC Central University, along with schools, shopping outlets, and churches. But after the spectacular failure of urban renewal, it was left vulnerable to crime, transitory housing, and underfunding that paved the way for gentrification. The $10 million to rebuild the community might be a drop in the bucket, but the money, the bulk of which comes from the Biden administration's American Rescue Plan, ARPA, of 2021, along with other city and county joint funding to address infrastructure issues, represents tangible hope. This month, Anita Scott Neville, the director of Haiti Reborn, a revitalization project with deep roots in the community, told the council about the importance of the city's response to the repair of the spiritual and physical harm to Haiti and its residents. Quote, the healing that will result from the revitalization will effectively drown out the residual pain from urban renewal of the 60s and echoes the resurrection of our heritage for generations to come, Scott Neville told the council days before the budget was approved. O'Neill told the Indy last week, I'm so proud of the community. They've been patiently waiting, and the waiting needed to be over. To talk about Haiti today among scholars and longtime residents is akin to visiting a one-time paradise in comparison to the issues that bedevil the community today. Haiti was one of the nation's most important black neighborhoods during the Jim Crow era, lauded in the early 1900s by W.E.B. Du Bois and Booker Washington, who rarely agreed on anything. Perhaps that's because Haiti embodied Washington's philosophy of enterprise and was emphasis on education. The sociologist E. Franklin Frazier, on his 1925 essay, Durham, Capital of the Black Middle Class, described the Bull City as the capital of the black bourgeoisie, a place, quote, not where men write and dream, but a place where black men calculate and work. He wrote, the Negro is at last developing a middle class, and its main center is in Durham. Henry McCoy told the Indy in 2021, it was the undisputed center of black capitalism and entrepreneurship, the leading black Wall Street in America. It was known as the city on the hill for blacks and the capital of the black middle class. McCoy is a founding member of Haiti Reborn, Durham Housing Authority rejected his bid to create an affordable housing, business, and educational complex in Hayti last year. McCoy was director of NC Central University's entrepreneurial program and last year accepted a position with the Biden administration to direct a newly created federal division to fund communities all over the country that are historically disadvantaged, marginalized, underserved, and overburdened by pollution. In other words, neighborhoods just like the Hayti district. 2 years ago, McCoy said the loss of Hayti's presence over the decades was incalculable. Quote, we're talking about literally billions of dollars in lost economic value for the Hayti community that could have resulted from expanding as a macroeconomic landscape expanded. Black Durham was denied the economic standing that it had built over the course of the century before the expressway came through. 2 years after the U.S. Supreme Court outlawed segregation in public schools, President Dwight Eisenhower signed into law the Federal Aid Highway Act of 1956 that authorized the construction of a 41,000-mile interstate highway system. The system is largely to blame for the destruction of formerly prominent black communities throughout the United States. The destruction of Hayti to make room for Highway 147 has its mirror images in black communities all along the nation's freeway corridors. South Central Avenue in Los Angeles, Beale Street in Memphis, 18th and Vine in Kansas City, Old City in Knoxville, the Third Ward in Houston, and the Hill District in Pittsburgh. The late celebrated Durham historian John Hope Franklin grew up in Tulsa and was only 4 years old in 1921 when a white mob destroyed 35 square blocks of the Greenwood District where he lived with his family. I, writes the author of this article, was writing Hayti's Ghost, for The Independent in 1997 when I had the good fortune to bump into Franklin. I shared with him my thoughts on what appeared to be a near conspiratorial destruction of prominent black communities throughout the United States. The vague, unfulfilled promises of redevelopment in Hayti and its kindred communities along the anatomy of the American landscape have proved to be nothing less than the economic murder of black America. After listening to my observations, Franklin said, I don't know if it happened to all of them, but it happened to enough of them. 1 year later, Franklin told me that Tulsa's Greenwood District was decimated by a highway, Interstate 244, just as highway was destroyed by 147. It was rebuilt after the white terrorism in 1921, but last year, Greenwood residents called for its removal to reverse 100 years of damage to the black community. Franklin told me for a second story I wrote, blacks recovered from the riots, but not from the interstate. I-244 destroyed it in a way the riots could not change it. It's against that backdrop that Durham city leaders approved funding to rebuild Hayti. Mark Anthony Middleton, the city's mayor pro tem, told Indy, I'm so excited. This has been talked about for generations. This means putting real dollars on the table. It's not a lot, but it's a significant amount. This is historic. O'Neill agreed. Hayti's neighborhood, she says, have been left out of the city's prosperity boom. She adds, now they can actually sit at the table, and they got a little bit of money. That's a big thing for the community. The community is going to have something to back it up. It's a great start. O'Neill explains that individual residents won't receive the funds. Instead, the city council will consider revitalization proposals from community groups, including the historic Fayetteville Street Corridor Planning Group, which is spearheaded by Larry and Denise Hester, who own the Phoenix Square and Phoenix Crossing shopping centers, and Hayti Promise, a nonprofit community development corporation started by the Hayti Heritage Center. The mayor says, I think we can all come together and have a grand vision that hopefully we can contract. O'Neill and Middleton value the currency of input from rank-and-file community members about the project. O'Neill says, my hope is they will come together and speak with one voice. Also cautioning, when you get to spending that kind of money, it can go fast. I'm hoping we can get the best bang for the buck. Funding for this revitalization project is happening at a fortuitous moment in the Fayetteville Street corridor history. There's the Durham Housing Authority's rather controversial planned development of Fayette Place, a 20-acre parcel of land that has been earmarked for the construction of 774 affordable housing units. There's also the planned redevelopment of the near-abandoned Heritage Square shopping center that sits between the 600 block of Fayetteville and the 400 block of East Lakewood Avenue. The eroding commercial strip was purchased last year by Sterling Bay, a Chicago-based development firm with deep pockets, whose officials announced the project as a joint venture with another Chicago firm and New York developer. Then there are the hundreds of luxury apartments built by Charlotte developer City Sculpt on more than 12 acres of land along South Roxborough and West Pettigrew that was once the commercial retail hub of the Hayti District. Moreover, North Carolina will host the World University Games in 2029 when 7,000 athletes from over 150 countries and more than 600 universities will compete at venues throughout the state's university hub region, Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill, Cary, and Greensboro. O'Neill says some of the events will take place on the campus of NC Central University, and she says the school's chancellor, Johnson O. Akinleye, hopes Hayti will be a destination spot when the athletes come in to help the campus and Durham. Hopefully, Hayti will look really different in 10 years, in a good way, says O'Neill. Days before council members approved that funding, several community members joined Scott Neville in the council chambers. During a June 5 work session, they spoke about the importance of rebuilding the district. Hayti resident Gordon Mathewson told the council, it's kind of difficult for you to see the vision of what took place, to actually see the economics of staying in your own community and also working with your own people for whatever you need. But that was what was provided before it was demolished. Faye Calhoun and another resident said, Hayti is such a unique area. It's African heritage we must be proud of, we must preserve, and we must recognize and acknowledge. Next, my longest article to read today from IndyWeek, Mayor Scher has written on June 22nd, Young Voters Are Shaping North Carolina's Political Landscape. Luis Valdivia Diego, 19, a rising sophomore from Anger, is studying public policy and economy at UNC Chapel Hill. He is a registered first-time voter who did not vote in the previous election. Valdivia Diego said he was wrestling with the course load during his first semester at college, saying, I was an hour away from home and I felt like I didn't have a method for voting in my county. He said he didn't know he could submit an absentee ballot or register to vote in Orange County. I guess it was also just nervousness of asking for help, he said. He's a first-generation Latino American. I'm treading the water firsthand with voting, and my immigrant family did not get to participate in that. He got interested and invested in political issues and believes in the right to vote, but did not grow up learning about voting, nor did he have the access to resources to learn how to navigate the process. Quote, I had to learn all these things like getting a driver's license or insurance by myself. And these weren't things that I, like many gifted families that are legal here, got the chance to learn from my parents. Valdivia Diego is part of North Carolina's diverse and sizable youth population age 18 to 42 that has the power to reshape the state's political landscape in elections, according to experts. compared with previous generations of young voters. There has been an overall upward trend for youth voting in North Carolina, with an increase of 9% in youth voter turnout from 2014 to 18, according to a report with the Center for Information and Research on Civic Learning and Engagement, known as CIRCLE, at Tufts University. But those born from 1981 to 2005, or Millennials and Generation Z voters, still have the lowest voter turnout of any generation in North Carolina. Michael Bitzer. Let's see, let me find my next page here. Excuse me. Michael Bitzer, a professor of politics and history at Catawba College in Salisbury, said, if you get these two generations, Millennials and Gen Z, to at least punch up to their political weight, there would be, I think, a very distinct political shift in the state. Bitzer studies youth voter demographics and trends in the state. Youth voters are not voting in numbers as large as their population, he said. Despite being the largest, most racially diverse group of potential voters in North Carolina, Millennial and Gen Z votes have the lowest voter turnout of any generation. This phenomenon poses both challenges and opportunities for the state's political landscape. With efforts to increase youth voter registration and participation, as well as the rise of unaffiliated young voters, there is a growing potential for a distinct political shift. Conservative leaders perceive the youth vote as a threat, leading to proposed measures to limit voter access, according to Bitzer. And Christopher Cooper, a professor of political science and public affairs at Western Carolina University in Cullowhee. Some Millennials and Gen Z voters say it isn't apathy or lack of interest that keeps young voters from the polls. Waad Hussein, a Muslim American of 27 years and user experience designer in Morrisville, recognizes the importance of voting and takes an interest in voting in her local elections, too. She's worked with Muslim Women For, a Cary-based nonpartisan grassroots organization, to engage Muslim Americans in the voting process. She said about lower youth voter turnouts, I don't think it's apathy, but it might be about feeling helpless or defeated in tough situations and maybe also a lack of trust in people of power. In terms of how significant this youth vote can be for the outcome of elections in states across the United States, North Carolina ranks 7th, according to the 2022 Youth Electoral Significance Index by CIRCLE, that group at Tufts. North Carolina also has the second largest population of college-educated adults older than 25 in the South, according to the American Community Survey. Approximately 1.5 million North Carolinians aged 25 to 44 have a high-quality degree or credential based on a 2021 statewide educational attainment report. Together, Millennials and Gen Z voters also make up the most racially diverse generations of voters in North Carolina, according to the demographic data from the North Carolina State Board of Elections. Among those born between 1946 and 1964, or the baby boomers, 71% of registered voters in the state are white, non-Hispanic or Latino, while among Gen Z registered voters, 52% are white, non-Hispanic or Latino. But not all younger voters report their race or ethnicity, and the number of non-white voters could be even higher. In 2020 in North Carolina, there were more than 387,000 eligible black youth voters, which, according to a 2020 CIRCLE report, is far higher than former President Donald Trump's margin of victory in the state. Despite their political weight in possibly altering the outcome of elections, Millennial and Gen Z turnout is lower than it could be. In the 2020 election, when 75% of registered voters showed up to the polls, a record turnout for North Carolina, Both Gen Z and millennials were at 61%, while boomers, 86%, said Bitzer. Shelley Trammell, a 22-year-old student from Shelby, runs the New Voters Project chapter at UNC Charlotte for students, PIRGS, and PIRGS, a nonpartisan nonprofit organization working to increase youth voter participation at public universities. Trammell is a dual major studying criminology and political science. She voted in her first election in 2018 and has since been working on education and educating student voters on civic engagement. And she said, "I hear a lot of people saying my voice isn't going to be heard, and many think it's bad for their mental health to engage with politics, but I always tell them, if you aren't thinking about your vote, you should know your bosses, your landlord, the rich people and corporations are thinking about it. If you're not voting, you're only helping the powerful hurt you in the long run." Overall, voter turnout among young people has been increasing, but not compared with the population of eligible young voters. Neil Michelson, associate professor of political science at Western Carolina University, says the voting rate for young voters had continuously dropped till we got to the 2020 election, when voting rates among younger people started to increase. This may be a reaction to the deep political polarization of the country and the Donald Trump phenomenon, he said. In the 22 general elections, for example, voter registration for millennials was at 26%, but only 18% cast their ballot. During the same period, Gen Z was at 13%, and only 6% voted, based on data from the State Board of Elections, analyzed by Bitzer. This shows the population of registered youth voters is larger than the turnout, or the number of youth voters actually casting their ballots. Some academic experts say youth voter turnout has always been low and is not an issue unique to millennials and Gen Z. Cooper said, "Young people, regardless of generation, don't turn out to vote in large numbers. The vast majority of the turnout gap is simply due to age. Young voters aren't as rooted in their communities, don't have a habit of voting, and aren't as convinced that voting is the way to make a change." Since the last presidential election, more young people have registered to vote in North Carolina, but it remains to be seen whether youth voter turnout will increase or continue to remain lower. Since 2020, more than 800,000 new voters registered in the state. About 53% of the state are younger than 35, compared with 25% in the previous election. The newly registered voters, according to the Carolina Population Center at UNC Chapel Hill. The number of newly registered youth voters has increased this year, and many of them could be first-time voters. Political scientists such as Bitzer are researching lower youth voter turnout, but organizers and young voters say that some reasons could be as simple as young people not having the education or resources to learn about how to register and the voting process, as well as the barriers to voting, access to polling locations, access to absentee ballots. Nonprofit and nonpartisan organizations in the state are striving to boost youth voter registration and participation ahead of elections to grapple with the perplexing challenge of low turnout among registered young voters. Daniel Gilligan is a co-founder of Current NC, a nonpartisan North Carolina-based organization that helps first-time voters navigate registration and voting. And he said, "We're trying to figure out what's causing North Carolina youth turnout to be much lower than other states with large voter populations like Wisconsin or Michigan. The outcome of the past few elections in Wisconsin and Michigan were driven by the youth vote. The voting process for youth is not the easiest and could be a reason for lower turnout, he said. Martha Plain, 19, runs the new Voters Project chapter at UNC Chapel Hill for student PIRGS. Plain is a queer student from Asheville studying political science. She's invested in educating first-time voters about the voting process. And she says, I don't think it's because young people don't care. It's because many don't have the resources or education to know how to jump through all the hoops it takes to vote these days. Any barriers to voting, like voter ID laws, make it harder for young people to vote and discourage them from doing so. In April, the North Carolina Supreme Court reversed an earlier ruling on voter IDs. Starting with the 23 municipal elections this September, voters will be required to show photo ID. For most, this would mean showing a North Carolina driver's license. But those who don't have a valid license would have to take additional steps to request an acceptable form of photo ID, according to the State Board of Elections. For young voters, particularly college students with hectic schedules, said Manny Wren, the executive director of the New Voters Project, the first step to voting is registering. The second is knowing how to cast your ballot, either through absentee or going in person back home, and then remembering to bring required documents, such as voter ID. Every day, every additional step to this process is going to make it more challenging. Some say the compounding of major global events like the pandemic and multiple recessions may have contributed to feelings of helplessness among young voters. Gilligan said younger voters have grown up and lived in a world where their country has been at war pretty much for their lifetime, and it could be easy to fall into nihilism or pessimism about the world. But it's exciting to see that they do want to stand up and do something about the issues that are important to them. Valdivia Diego plans on voting in the next election and the upcoming presidential election in 2024. Hussein is hopeful that the youth voter turnout will increase. She said millennials and Gen Z are passionate and say what's on their mind publicly. They mobilize themselves and don't wait on others to lead them. Plan agrees. Social media has revolutionized the way that young people view politics, and I think that Gen Z is coming into democracy fired up. Many young voters are interested in political issues and do want to participate in voting, but often don't have the knowledge or access to resources on how to register or vote. Voters under the age of 42 are driving the rise of the unaffiliated voter status in the state. Blitzer said these two generations are recognized as the most racially diverse, and Gen Z will probably be the most educated generation of any generation in U.S. history. And if you look at the Gen Z cohort, at present they're getting close to 50% registered unaffiliated status. In the past, the silent boomer, that's the cohort that preceded baby boomer, and Generation X blocks of voters were more evenly divided in their partisan identification, according to a Pew Research Center report on partisanship across generations. With millennials, the divide grew, with more than 51% identifying as Democrats, 35% as Republicans. In the United States, we've never seen that big of a partisan gap in generational politics, said Bitzer. While, now, this article I might mention, as there is a bar chart with a bunch of statistics that it's hard to read, so I'm not going to read it. I'll just continue the article itself. White North Carolinians make up the largest percentage of unaffiliated voters at 66%. In 2020, according to a 2020 study on unaffiliated North Carolina voters. Well, that was efficient. Young voters are less invested in political parties than the issues that are important, like gun violence, environment, and reproductive rights, among others. Gilligan said. There is a party preference, but that's not the driving force, and they're not interested in candidates the same way older generations are. There's a stark divide between the two parties on important issues, and it's those issues that drive young votes. Cooper has also seen, through his research into young affiliated voters, that many young voters are increasingly choosing not to identify with political parties. He said that they're just more distrustful of political parties. But part of this is also that our primaries are now open to unaffiliated voters, whereas in the past, if you registered as an unaffiliated, you were shut out of the primaries. Bitzer sees the rise of unaffiliated voters to be a response to the deep partisan divide in the country. He said, I think the rise of the unaffiliated younger vote among Gen Z is just a classic response to their political environment. By registering unaffiliated, they're saying we don't want any labels associated with us. The youth vote and voter suppression methods have been heavily debated among conservative leaders. In North Carolina, a series of bills have been proposed on voting and the election process. In April, Cleta Mitchell, conservative lawyer and Republican legal strategist who recently moved to North Carolina, was reported to be planning to limit voter access and turnout for young voters and students in North Carolina and other states. She said, conservatives must band together to limit voting on college campuses. Same-day voter registration and automatic mailing of ballots to registered voters. Our constitutional republic's survival is at stake. Mitchell was a key figure in the attempt to reverse the 2020 presidential election and runs the Election Integrity Network at the Conservative Partnership Institute. That's a coalition of conservative leaders and citizens. If young people voted at the same rates as older voters, it would change who gets elected, Cooper said. Bitzer says voters under the age of 40 are turning against Republican orthodoxy, philosophy, ideology, and policy perspectives. I think the overall generational dynamics at play here in North Carolina point to a real problem for the Republican Party among younger voters. Various suppression methods are being proposed for this reason, to keep turnout lower in the younger demographic, he said. Carolina Public Press contacted Mitchell to ask her about these comments and proposed measures to suppress young voters, but didn't receive a response. Gilligan said, commenting on Mitchell's statements about youth voters, the fact they're paying this much attention to try to suppress young people's votes tells you that it's something of importance. I think that through oppressive politics, they're trying to get rid of democracy. All right, I have time for at least one music review, and I'm glad to be able to get a little bit of culture specific into these broadcasts. And the first one is written by Brian Howe. On June 28th, and it's about Phil Venables, Bringing the Light, and it's released on Soul City Sounds, and it came out on June 16th. Phil Venable records and releases music under the umbrella of Soul City Sounds, a small imprint that cultivates a unique intersection of jazz, poetry, and the artier side of old-school Chapel Hill indie rock. The imprint is especially notable for releasing The River Speaks of Thirst, a revelatory first album by North Carolina Poet Laureate Jackie Shelton Green in 2020. The album brushed Green's innately musical verses with jazz so wispy it was basically ambient. The collaboration continued the next year with a more orchestral but nearly as subdued setting of Green's I Want to Undie You, or I Want to Undie You, that's more likely. Now, she has returned to Soul City Sounds as a guest on Venable's Bringing the Light, but this time with a band that's letting it rip. Bringing the Light is a three-track extended play of spiritual free jazz following the star of protean saxophonist Pharoah Sanders, who died last fall. Playing guitar and upright bass himself, Venable assembled a rather inspired quartet. The kit of veteran North Carolina jazz drummer Tommy Jackson blends with the hand percussion of Ken Moshish, a D-Town brass member with a storied Bay Area history. In the spotlight is shadowy saxophonist Crow Meat Bob Pence, a comparative youngster in this seasoned ensemble who has still been a crossover fixture in local jazz and experimental music for decades. Pence opens the valley with an ominous purr, then blows a bluesy geometry over scattering percussion. On The Climb, the band shatters a sultry groove and pits it against the powerful undertow of Green's poem, Love Note to the Ancestors. To hear her verses in a more aggressive context is very interesting. There's a movement halfway through when music and words seem to be on the verge of separating onto different tracks, but it occasions a thrilling moment when Green slams them back together, speeding her cadence on the repeated word, now. Likewise, The View shows a new side of Chapel Hill-based gospel singer Jennifer Evans, who sings fluid runs and weighty lyrical fragments that connect Black Lives Matter and 60s civil rights protest over music that sounds like a psych rock construction site. On Bringing the Light, the sound and language sometimes seem to have a bit more distance between them than they did on prior poetic melds, which takes some getting used to, but is just evidence of a collaboration growing bolder, with many haunting and heroic moments to be found. And again, the name of this release, Bringing the Light by Phil Venable. Soul City Sounds, the label. And Jordan Lawrence writes about Django Haskins' release, self-released world, Lost World, and gives it 4-star reviews. And this is a while that's to be released on July 27th. It's no surprise that an album born from an exercise to help maintain creativity during the pandemic would concern itself with distance. Django Haskins' Lost World, the first piano-led collection from the Old Ceremony songwriter, draws on roughly 120 songs and counting he has penned since May 2020, spurred by a group of friends who started getting together virtually once a week to share a new song and get feedback. The 8 songs culled for the album constantly assess distances with a yearning to overcome them. Some of these distances are physical. Some are formed by the mortality and loss that Haskins notes as persistent themes, and some are even more metaphysical, taking stock of the divide between what you want the world to be and what it is. The music is a fitting backdrop for such lonely contemplative ruminations. With the patient piano parts, Haskins recorded solely at his Calvander Sound Studio in Chapel Hill, reveling in the echoing distance between keystrokes. The record, finished in post-production with help from Chris Stamey of the DBs, adds subtle ethereal embellishments from guitar, bass, drums, and saxophone, provided by the Mountain Goats' Matt Douglas, to juice the feeling that these songs emanate from far away, hoping to find a sympathetic listener. That's exactly the kind of distance Haskins feels on Woodpecker, which finds the narrator sitting alone in an abandoned city, sending out notes in bottles. The lyric, like a record of Johnny B. Goode sent to echo forever in space, we go searching for an innocent ear in the universe's empty face. Opener Man in C examines the distance that can form between parents and children. Haskins sings from the perspective of the son of famed aviator Charles Lindbergh, who became a diver to form his own legacy. My father flew, and so I dove, he intones, where his shadow cannot go. from an airplane, looks out at a world filled with chaos, and finds comfort in the false notion of control conjured by watching from above. From an airplane, I control the seas. I form a window in the economy. The album closer, Will There Be Time, dreads life's inevitable separation between loved ones, wondering if there will be enough time to do everything he wants to do with his family. Quote, it's not like we're sitting around doing nothing. We're building a beautiful life, and I almost cry when I look at our children. They never understand why. Carried forth by Haskins' expressive singing, actorly but never overdramatic, each of these earnest exercises tugs at thoughts that haunt life's quiet moments. As such, it's a product of the pandemic that should have a long shelf life. That's Lost World by Django Haskins, and written 4 stars, review by Jordan Lawrence from Indie Week. And to close Indie Week, I can just present a national story that's already hit the headlines, in that the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that the Harvard and the University of North Carolina's admission processes violate equal protection clause of the 14th Amendment. And that was a 6-3 decision which came out this morning, which was on June the 29th. Quote, because Harvard and UNC admissions program lack sufficiently focused and measurable objectives warranting the use of race, unavoidably employ race in a negative manner, involve racial stereotyping, and lack of meaningful endpoints, these programs cannot be reconciled with the guarantees of the Equal Protection Clause, wrote Roberts. Many universities have for too long wrongly concluded the touchstones of an individual's identity is not challenges bested, skills built, or lessons learned, but the color of their skin. This nation's constitutional history does not tolerate that choice. Because Harvard is a private institution and UNC public, this decision affects higher education across the board. Well, I can continue with that article, actually I can't, because we're due to expire very shortly. And I will just say that this entire article can be found on IndieWeek.com. And for now, John Federshen will have to sign off, and we'll be back with you next week with another edition of the Indie Week. Thanks for listening from North Carolina Reading Service.